Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today. Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Welcome to Unhappy Hour, the show where we bitch about all the things we love to hate every single week. I'm your host, Matt Bellassai. I'm here in my closet recording, not as far, far away from my producer, Barry Finkel. Hi, Barry.
Hey, Matt. Oh, it's like I can feel you so close to me.
We're mere blocks from one another compared to before. Oh, what a miracle.
I love it.
All right, coming up today, we're going to kick things off with Worst Things First, where I chat about the stupidest, most ridiculous, worst news of the week. After that, we're diving deep into moving, because I just moved from Manhattan to Brooklyn during a pandemic. And listen, I've got a lot of pent-up frustrations that I need to get out. And then we've got Jasmine Hughes on the pod. Jasmine is a Metro reporter at the New York Times. She's written for Elle, Cosmopolitan, Teen Vogue, New York Times Magazine. She's funny. She loves to complain. And she was under deadline during our conversation. And I will always respect that level of procrastination. Always. But before we get into all that, Barry, how was your week? How was this week in Quore?
I'm back in New York. My neck went out again, but it's all okay because you live in exactly 15-minute walk from my door to your door. We got to hang out this weekend, so that was really wonderful. So I'd say I'm starting off this week pretty great. I would ask how you are, but I also have a feeling we're going to get into it in the deep dive, but maybe just like a quick preview. How was your quarantine week?
I will say I Googled this morning with some of my symptoms, and it was the first time I ever felt better about anything after Googling symptoms.
Wow. Wow. You're the only person on this planet. Incredible.
Yeah. WebMD, actually, the Mayo Clinic, they do two things really well: making mayonnaise and scaring the shit out of people when you Google symptoms. And today I got absolutely neither. I didn't get any mayonnaise for my chicken salad, and I didn't get bad news when I Googled symptoms. No, I mean, obviously moving, I was lifting a lot of heavy stuff, so I was worried about my back. And basically I Googled what a herniated disc is, and it was less scary than I thought.
Yeah. It can be manageable for sure.
Right. It's not like, oh, you're fucked
forever. Life. Yeah, no.
Temporarily. Ideally temporarily, unless it doesn't go away or I start losing control of my bladder. So we'll see. On that note, let's get into it. Let's do it. Let's start the show. All right, worst things first. Let's talk about the worst news of the week. First, German police say they're losing hope trying to find who left a box of vials on a train thought to contain the DNA from hamsters.
Why?
What is happening? I don't know. Yeah, what like German supervillain is breeding killer hamsters somewhere in Berlin? This is a Godzilla situation just waiting to happen.
That'd be a really, really cute Godzilla, though.
No! Did you ever see Nutty Professor 2?
I can't say that I have.
They blow up a hamster. It gets super big and scary. And then it humps a man who's wearing a fur coat, obviously, because this was the early 2000s. And this was the peak of comedy in
height,
cinema.
Absolute.
And yeah, I remember we saw that at a drive-through movie theater. It was a double feature. It was like a Big Mama's House. Nutty Professor 2.
Incredible.
Double feature. Only the best. Only the best. Anyway.
This sounds less like a comedy, more like an action thriller.
There's no way this ends well. There's no situation in which someone finds abandoned hamster DNA on a train in Germany. Someone who is not keeping good track of the DNA that they're carting around. I don't trust it.
No, that's not something... it's not a granola bar. You know, you don't just like misplace... Do people misplace granola bars?
All the time I do. Every morning I wake up, I have to check my... I leave my apartment, I go keys, wallet, granola bar, and I always forget.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, officers had hoped to crack the case by publicizing the find, but despite intense media interest, the owner of the hamster DNA has remained... elusive.
That's how you know it's fucked up DNA.
Yeah.
If it were just like your run-of-the-mill hamster DNA, someone would be like, oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, that was mine. I got off at the wrong stop. I just like completely, totally weird day. But no, if no one steps up for that, it's like, oh God, they cannot connect me to that DNA because there's some fucked up shit in there.
Something is wrong. There is something they're not telling us. Police said that they disposed of the vials as the cold chain had been broken. I don't really know what that means.
I don't know
but
what
the
that
point is.
Is,
oh good. Yeah, sure. Just throw it away. So now it's in the sewer system. That's just what we need. Some German mutant hamster gators. German mutant hamster gators.
I'd watch that show.
Yeah. I do like to think that these vials included just little hamster sperm samples, like from some hamster sperm bank for hamster mothers who want to have little hamster babies but don't want to wait for some man.
What a beautiful image.
Next, speaking of strong, powerful women who don't need no man, experts at the St. Louis Zoo are trying to figure out how a 62-year-old ball python laid 7 eggs despite not being near a male python for at least 2 decades.
Shiro, Shiro, Shiro.
Yeah, first of all, absolute Shiro for going 2 full decades without having to interact with a man.
Ugh,
honestly,
icon,
enviable.
Legend.
Second of all, who says older women can't be sex symbols? This ball python proving them wrong. I like to think her name is like Estelle, like a classy older woman.
Oh, absolutely.
Because she doesn't have a name, unfortunately. They never named her.
What?
I guess they didn't have time in 6 decades to name this fucking snake. So anyway, Estelle, I'll call her Estelle the Snake, the ball python. She's this beautiful, sleek, older woman approaching retirement age saying, guess what? I'll fuck myself and lay some eggs. The manager of the kind of snake department at the zoo said it was unusual but not rare for ball pythons to reproduce asexually. These snakes can sometimes store sperm for delayed fertilization.
Sick, bruh.
So she's just been keeping a little sack of sperm in her for 2 full decades.
Just a little ball in her pocket, you know?
That's exactly what Mary did in the Bible. And then everyone was like, oh, she's a virgin. No, she was just storing it. The guy also said that birth is unusual because ball pythons usually stop laying eggs long before they reach their 60s. Not Estelle.
Mm-mm.
She said, I'm going to shit out these eggs no matter how old I am. I'll put on my eyeliner right before I go to bingo and I'll shit out some eggs. She'd definitely be the oldest snake we know of in history to lay eggs. This guy said, noting that she's the oldest snake ever documented at the St. Louis Zoo. Oh, in any zoo.
Oh my God.
In a zoo.
She is a record breaker.
This is literally what the Guinness Book of World Records was made for. Whoever Guinness was he made beer, and then he made a big old book that comes out once a year that should be dedicated to Estelle the ball python, because she is breaking all of them. And finally, a sheriff's deputy in Georgia was delivering civil papers, don't really know what that means, when she heard something in her patrol car. Turns out a goat had climbed into the open driver's seat, ate a bunch of paperwork, knocked over a drink, and then bumped the deputy to the ground.
Damn!
Fred the goat radicalizes another comrade against the police state. Yes.
Oh, proud of you, Fred. Yes.
I guess the sheriff's office explained in a Facebook post that the deputy, they leave their car doors open on calls like this in case like they have to escape quickly because of aggressive dogs, but that the deputy did not consider having to retreat from an agitated goat. I guess you'll think again next time.
Honestly, all of these stories make me want to get a goat.
I mean, the problem with getting a goat is, A, you're going to have to deal with its kind of long-term radicalization.
Right.
But B, you have no idea when that thing is going to escape.
That's true. They're sneaky motherfuckers.
Fred could come by at any time and set that man free, and you would have no idea. It's beyond your control. When asked for comment, the goat reportedly said, bah, which, according to my training as a goat interpreter, it roughly translates. I mean, I only went to like a year of schooling for this, but according to my translation, it roughly means, there is no such thing as blue lives, because becoming a police officer is an occupation and not an identity that you are born with, like race, which is why saying blue lives matter is meaningless and insulting to black and brown communities who are systematically discriminated against long before they were able to choose a career from like what they saw in Paw Patrol. I don't know if that's an exact translation, but
definitely.
It's close. It's close. So good for that goat. I think he totally gets it. And on that note, that's it for Worst Things First. Next, we're diving deep into the horrors of moving. Deep dive, deep dive, deep dive, deep dive, deep dive. Deep dive, deep dive, deep dive, deep dive, deep dive. All right. Well, if you haven't picked up on it yet, I moved this week. Did you know that? Have I said it yet?
Wait, you moved?
Hadn't you heard? I moved during a pandemic and a recession and my period, which is the heaviest it's been in months, because that's always how it is, isn't it, ladies? Just when you need it least, bam, blue gel everywhere, all over my pants. But really, this was literally the most stressful week I've had in a long time. And before you get all high and mighty and be like, oh, Matt, it's because you waited to do all the work on moving until 10 days before you actually had to move. You shut your dirty mouth, okay? Sorry, I'm not Miss Cleo. Sorry, I can't see into the future more than 2 weeks ahead of time and could see what's going to happen and know what I'm supposed to do. You're asking me to plan ahead like I'm some sort of mountaintop oracle that all of the oily men of Sparta come to for advice? I don't care if I'd started planning my move 9 months in advance and let it gestate in my colon like a tiny demon. Moving is stressful as heck, okay? Full stop. It doesn't matter how long you wait to actually do anything. So let's talk about it. This is why moving is the worst. First, why the hell do I have so much stuff? I honestly don't know how beavers do it. They manage to keep all those sticks and leaves and piles of mud without going insane, and then they just pick it up and move it like it's nothing with their big chunky teeth. But for real, every time I packed a box and then looked up and realized how much stuff I still had to pack, I had to like sit down and do a full fetal position wail, just curled up like a little roly-poly, and then primal scream.
Well, yeah, because like each box that you fill and you look around and it's like, oh, I've done absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Like it looks like it makes no difference because it's also like all the stuff that's in drawers that you're putting away, but it still looks like there's stuff in there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Even when I was packing like the last box, I was still like, I feel like there's still shit everywhere.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like you're making any progress at any point. It is just stuff upon stuff upon stuff. I use this rental like bin service. So they drop off the bins and then you fill them and then they pick them up where you move. You select like I'm moving from a one bedroom and they were like, okay, that'll be 30 bins. I ended up using 45 bins. And then I still had to go to Home Depot and then get like 12 more extra large boxes. For a one-bedroom apartment. I had to go to fucking Home Depot, which is illegal. And each of my boxes, they weighed approximately one whole Clifford the dog. It was, I don't understand why everything is so heavy. You don't think about it when it's like just in your house and then suddenly you pick up one book and it's like, why do you weigh 30 pounds? Also makes you question like why you bought anything in the first place. The number of times this week where I like looked at my stuff and I was like, I could absolutely burn this all to the ground, move to Tibet, and become a monk.
And yet you can't, like, even though you know that you could burn everything that's there, the idea of getting rid of anything is the hardest in the whole world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the one thing I will say about if I had started earlier... Because, like, I got everything that I needed to do done.
You did it. You moved.
But if I had started sooner, I would have been able to go through all of my stuff and gotten rid of a bunch of stuff. But my attitude toward the end was like, fuck it. It's all going in the bins and I'm bringing it all with. And the problem now is that my new apartment does have a lot more space. And now I just have room to shove everything in corners, which is a problem. Because I cannot accumulate more garbage. I need to get rid of stuff. Marie Kondo had a point. And I hate giving her credit because she told me to whisper I love you to my socks. But you know what? She made a point. Every time I backed a box, I was like, materialism is a sin. And whoever bought all of this stuff is going straight to hell.
But also, I love all of it.
Next. Also, moving is expensive as heck. I don't know how the circus manages to stay in business when they have to move from town to town every few days.
Oh my God, great point.
All the circus freaks must be on the verge of bankruptcy just all the time. You got to pay a security deposit, first month's rent, and all the fees at the new place. Then you got to pay the old place to fix up all of the semen stains that you left. And then you got to pay for boxes and the bins. You got to pay movers. You got to pay to finally dispose of the body you had stuffed in the back of the closet this whole time. It's a miracle I have anything left, frankly.
Truly.
You have to deal with the possibility that one of your movers could be the hunky man of your dreams.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, it's the day that I'm moving. I'm more stressed than I've ever been in my life. And now I have to look cute enough to potentially meet my future second husband.
I mean, it's also kind of a good moment to meet your future husband because it's like he's seeing you at a very low point and it's like, oh, you, and he's there to help. And like, that's a beautiful thing for a relationship, you know? It's like starting low, but you know he's already there for you. Also, what did you end up wearing?
A jock strap and... a mesh tank, but it was slightly uncomfortable. I was very sweaty.
So when's the wedding?
Well, we'll see. First of all, you didn't hear me say second husband because,
oh my God, I'm so sorry.
Obviously, I wouldn't marry the mover right away. You know, we'd keep in touch. We'd have sort of like a moment on the day of the move, and then we'd keep in touch. And then when my first marriage starts getting a little sour, me and the mover would start up like a little thing on the side. And then one year I'd be like, oh, you know, I'm going to go on a business retreat to Cincinnati. But actually, I just buy a one-way plane ticket to like Vancouver.
Mm.
And the mover and I, we would buy like a Canadian maple syrup farm.
Ooh, love that.
And we'd run like a little bed and breakfast on our estate there. And that's, you know, that's just the kind of bliss that you can't just rush into.
No.
You have to let it build. But yeah, so on moving day, I have the pressure of all of that. I have to prepare for that meet cue, the possibility of that meet cue, and the pressure of my entire future ahead of me. Fortunately, none of my movers were really that hot, so I didn't have that pressure.
Oh, good.
Because I don't think I could have handled it. Next, I'll just say it. I hate tipping. And by that, I don't mean I hate paying people for the services that they provide. I just hate having to guess how much I should tip. I don't like the like guessing game. I don't like the like awkwardness of how much it should be. Just include it in the price of things. This right. applies to everything. Why do we live in a society where tipping is just include it in the price so we don't like have to guess?
And I just want to state, you do tip.
I tip. But the problem also is that my approach to avoiding the awkwardness of it is that I often like wildly overtip.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I'm just like, I don't want to deal with the awkwardness of it. So it ends up like the confusion ends up being more expensive for me. But it's like, yeah, I feel like most European countries like don't have like a tipping system. It's just like the price of things is what it is. The point is, we need to band together to eat Jeff Bezos. Also, you get to discover all the fun little flaws your new place has that you didn't realize were there upon first inspection. Like how loud the neighbors make whoopee at night. Or like how there's a herd of feral city cats in the alleyway outside your bedroom window that host a wild jellicle ball every night at midnight. Or in my case, the fact that the microwave is apparently purely decorative and does not actually function. Which I learned the hard way when I was trying to melt butter yesterday.
Wait, I know this is a very annoying question, but was it plugged in?
Yeah, it was fucking plugged in, okay? The microwave fully like works. Like it's on and I put it in and like I punch the number in and I press start and I set the power. The power was set to 100%. And I microwaved butter for like 45 seconds and it absolutely nothing happened.
No.
It was still cold. So it's really just if the point of this microwave is if you just want to have like a little fashion show and you put your butter or your microwave popcorn on the little stand and then it twirls around under the lights.
Nothing actually happens.
So yeah, gonna have to figure that out. I guess I just won't eat for several days. And finally, you just have to interact with too many people. Brokers, movers, new neighbors, the creepy old man who lives inside the walls and escapes once a night through the vents to make potty and gently lick your face while you're sleeping. I don't want to talk to any of these people. I just want to get in my little pillow fort and go to sleep and be done with it.
Amen.
But honestly, yeah, at the end of all the craziness, you're all settled and cozy and moved in and you get to start a new chapter of your life. And I guess that's exciting. So I'll take it.
And now you're my neighbor.
And now I'm your neighbor. And I get to take a fat shit on your front lawn whenever I want. And that's it for this week's deep dive. Next, we got Jasmine Hughes on the pod right after this commercial break.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
My guest complainer today is writer Jasmine Hughes. She's written for Elle, Cosmopolitan, Vogue, or Teen Vogue, excuse me. Even better, honestly.
Oh, and regular and Vogue. Don't get it twisted. Both Vogues.
And now is a full-time writer and editor at the New York Times. You know, no big deal. Welcome, Jasmine.
Thank you, Matt Balanci. I am happy to be here, but not happy about anything else.
Right, which is perfect. That is the attitude I like to hear, only for this podcast and not actually for personal, you know. I don't want you to be deteriorating as a person, but for the sake of my podcast, I'm glad you are.
I'm going to talk it up. Don't worry. Let's go.
So, I mean, we'll jump right in then. We like to get started by asking, what is one thing you hate that everybody else loves?
The thing that I detest more than anything in the world that everyone loves is dessert. I go out to dinner all the time, even though we're in the middle of a global health pandemic. And when I got to dinner with friends, we had a delicious meal, we had two glasses of wine, and we're all like lounging on each other. And then the waiter comes by with the dessert menu. That's when I fly into a rage, because I fucking hate dessert.
Fly into a rage.
What's the goddamn point of dessert? I don't understand.
Okay, this is the one. Usually, I feel like it is my accommodating nature to go along with my guest and to say, you know what, I hate that thing too. But this is egregious, frankly. Is it just that you are full and that like you don't need any more? Are you just not interested in any of the dessert items?
I find that presentation of sugar to be insulting. Listen, I'll never turn down food. If after consuming a huge meal, a waiter came by, asked if I wanted like a digestif of potato chips or like another like mini steak, I would say yes. Mm-hmm. But you know, Matt Balanci, I'll tell you a story. 7 years ago when I was young and stupid, I gave my DNA to the government because I wanted to know where my ancestors came from.
Uh-huh.
First of all, in your 23andMe results, if you're a black person, it didn't really tell you very much about where your ancestors came from. So I got screwed over on that one. But it did tell me that I have a genetic predisposition to savory foods, which made me feel so much better about my lifelong aversion to the following items, like a chocolate croissant, like a mousse, or a fruit tart, which I fully just eat a piece of fruit. I fully don't understand. Ice cream, I don't really.
You're just listing things you hate.
These are all things that I would never in my life pay money for. If I'm feeling incredibly stressed, I might take a tiny bite of someone's. I'll have a piece of birthday cake on somebody else's birthday. For my birthday, I choose to have a birthday lasagna complete with candles.
Ooh, okay, that I can get behind.
Oh, listen, that's the one thing that we can agree on. But dessert itself, I find offensive, I find it uninteresting, and it's bland.
Have you ever had a dessert in New York that has been in any way? I know this is like conversion therapy ideology, saying like maybe you just haven't had the right, you haven't met the right dessert. But have you ever had a dessert that made you reconsider? Made you think twice for a second?
I like the banana pudding at Magnolia. I eat it like once a year and I'm good.
That is a once a year food though. That is like that banana pudding is so, so thick and rich. And it's, if you have that more than once a year, you'll die.
I had it last summer and I'm still tasting it. I'm fine.
Yeah. It is a staple of New York dessert foods and it is only consumable in that quantity. You mentioned going out to eat and how often you've gone out to eat in the past, I guess, however long restaurants have kind of been open. I have yet to do the outdoor dining thing. It feels horrible to me, but you're doing it.
Oh, well, a little known fact about me is that I have a kink for eating while high beams are being shown in my face while I'm sitting in the middle of DeKalb Avenue. There's nothing more insulting to the human condition than waiting for a table to sit in the street.
to sit in the middle of a major thoroughfare of Brooklyn and have like cars and bikes and scooters and delivery people and children and skateboarders whiz past you while you're like pretending that you're, you know, that you're like dining in the south of France, like you're dining al fresco in something really incredibly romantic. There are rats scurrying by. There are heaps of trash, like within eye distance, within nose distance, within smell distance. And yet, I don't know how to cook. So this is what I got to do.
How did you eat when restaurants were like fully closed? Takeout exclusively?
I ate a lot of eggs. I think I might have just eaten eggs for 2 months. I sort of blacked out. I don't really remember. And a rotisserie chicken probably fell in once or twice. Eggs and cereal. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Honestly, that is 90% of my diet. I think that the world has gone back and forth over whether eggs are actually good for you or not. I feel like it's one of those foods that's like, well, you eat one egg and your cholesterol is through the roof, but also like it has protein and I don't know. I just feel like we need to get on the same page as a society about what eggs are doing.
You know, I'll tell you, one of my best friends eats 4 to 6 eggs every single day and he looks like Jewish Hercules. So I'm trying to be like him. I think eggs are great.
That's great. I would say 1, send me his info. And 2, I probably do eat like at least 3 eggs a day.
Oh yeah, that's how I start my day. I think eggs, they're delicious. They're hard to fuck up. They really come in a pinch if, I don't know, for example, you find yourself in a global health crisis where everything is shut down and you are relegated to being in your home for several months by yourself and you can't cook.
Yeah. You get 1 carton of eggs. That's a meal for a week or a day if you're a Jewish Hercules. How has your like quarantine been? What's the temp check right now?
Temperature is hot because I have a social life now. I think everyone is like very slowly warming up to outdoor dining and I am the bridge because I'm at a restaurant every day. I've become a regular at a restaurant since COVID began. Nice. The hostess gave me her cell phone number the other day.
Okay. Like real, real regular.
Yeah. I go out all the time. If you called me and said, "Hey, Jasmine, can we get a drink?" I would say, "Matt, the next time I'm free is next Tuesday." So I'm having a very busy, weirdly busy time.
Which is great. I mean, I do feel like it feels like the mood, at least temporarily, has maybe right now, it almost feels like the eye of the hurricane is over us. And where it's like, okay, let's enjoy the sunshine while we can.
While we can, before we're made to go back inside in the colder months. And I also want to amend all this and say that I get COVID tested more than anyone I know because I go to restaurants more than anyone I know. So every Monday morning before I have my eggs, I go to the health clinic down the street from my house and get my nose swabbed and get my results back later that week. So no COVID yet, but I know that for certain.
Amazing. That is a routine. That is a true.
I've been COVID tested 7 times.
Oh my God. I'm still like kind of not scared. It's just like, I don't want anybody tickling my brain.
It's less but of I a guess... brain tickle. It's more like you're in a pool and you've inhaled a little bit too much chlorine in your nose. Oh,
that is the weird. That's worse than if you just said my brain was going to be tickled. That visual sent me back to a dark place.
But it kind of, you're like, oh, it's still summer. I'm still getting like that chlorine blur up my nose, even though I haven't seen any of my friends, family, or loved ones in several months. It's still summer.
Sure. Yeah. That feeling of like near drowning, it was always like, okay, at least reminiscent of a nicer time. So we're mixing misery and joy here. So you are now full-time at the New York Times. Is that correct?
Oh, I've worked at the Times for 5 years full-time. I've been an editor for 5 years, but now I'm a full-time writer.
Full-time writer. Got it. I knew there was an announcement in the past couple of weeks, yeah, and I wasn't sure that the actual specific. So, but now you're going to be sort of splitting time between the magazine and the Metro section?
Yes, indeed. The next couple of months, I will just be writing for the Metro section just to, like, learn the ropes on how to report, since I don't know how to be a reporter. And then in early next year, I will split my time writing stories for the magazine and for Metro. Here's the thing, Matt, about becoming a full-time writer is that people expect you to write. So I'm currently on a deadline for a story that I'm supposed to be writing, and I don't want to do it. I just don't want to do it. And yet it has to be done because this is my job now. And so I feel like Go Bluth in Arrested Development, just like I've made a huge mistake.
Yeah. That is the worst part about writing, is writing.
And then you have to keep doing it. It's fucked up. Honestly, it's sick.
Do you work well on a deadline?
I work well under immense stress and fear that I will be fired, or like a dragon will come and eat me, or my editor will make fun of me in front of everybody in the entire world. Yes. I can only work if I'm under stress.
Right. So, yeah, you respond well to shame and
I was homeschooled. Yes, of course. I went to a religious homeschool. I love shame. It's my only motivator.
That's true. I think that the moment that I became like not really Catholic was the moment that my productivity really took a dive, because it was like, oh, if Jesus is not going to be mad at me for not doing my homework,
right? Then what am I doing here? What's the point? No, I think there should be more shame in this world, honestly. And anytime someone does something I find egregious, I'm sort of like, where are your friends? Like, who was holding you accountable for the terrible things that you're doing? Like, why aren't your friends roasting you in the group chat? You should be embarrassed. You should be embarrassed of yourself. When you're racist, I'm like, you should be embarrassed. That's embarrassing. Somebody should be making fun of you.
You've also been, I read this, but also you said it before we started recording, that you've been learning how to skateboard.
Oh, yeah. So this was a year in which I was convinced I was going to die. Because I don't know if you know this based off the several mentions of COVID so far in this podcast, but there's a global health crisis.
Not
so
listening.
Between that,
yeah, right.
And
in case anyone forgot, not listening or forgot,
We are in the middle of a global health pandemic. But between COVID and the uprisings around anti-Black racism and racial justice that emerged over throughout the country, rather, over the course of the summer and including up till, you know, yesterday and today, and watching the anger and fear experienced by some people in white communities and non-Black communities become mobilized towards violence, I was just scared of everything all the time. So at the end of April, I got a skateboard off of Craigslist because I had been inside for 5 weeks and no one had touched me, but also no one had given me any attention. So I was like, I would like to impress a girl. I don't know which girl, I don't know where, I don't know how, but I gotta do something so I can flirt again. And I'd been teaching myself how to skateboard. And it's very scary. But it turns out if you are afraid of everything else all the time, skateboarding can actually be incredibly freeing.
That is true. When your fear is put in perspective, it makes some of the other stuff seem... It makes falling off a skateboard seem quaint.
When I'm looking at COVID and police brutality and anti-Black racism, I'm like, I could do an ollie. Please.
Right.
That's nothing. That's a piece of cake. But not literally, because cake is disgusting.
Okay. Well, just slip that one in there. There is something also I feel like that strikes. I feel like skateboarders on the sidewalk strike fear in me. And there is something I think powerful about learning to skate in order to strike that fear into other people. And I just mean, like, I could see a 5-year-old, like, little preppy boy on a skateboard, and I can't go near it. It's too scary to me. Well, because that kid has no control. That those wheels could go wildly off the chains at any minute, and I'm at risk.
So every time you leave your home, are you terrorized by bands of 5-year-olds on skateboarders just like extolling their personal agency and holding it over your head?
I find children following their dreams and expressing themselves to be personally threatening. I was trained from a very young age to, every time I open the front door, to be afraid of everything. And I don't know how much my mother knows, like, the damage that she did in this respect. But that is the attitude that I go out into the world with, which is, perhaps oddly fitting for our time right now. But it makes finding those moments of joy a little bit harder.
And but they're so much more worth it when you're able to actually find them. Up until, let's say, 3 weeks ago, I didn't think I knew how to ride a bike because I hadn't in 5 years because I had fallen off of one and refused to get back on. I don't know how to drive. I barely know how to swim. I know how to not die in a body of water. So I don't know how to do very much with my body. So when I got on the skateboard for the first time, I was like, this is an incredible way to lose the set of teeth that I've spent the past, you know, 20 years trying to grow. But first of all, didn't have anything better to do with my time in April, May, and June. But secondly, I wanted to, again, impress the girls. But thirdly, I guess, and most importantly, I was searching for some control over the fear that I had been feeling all the time. Mm-hmm. And this was a fear that I created for myself. And so I felt like I could define the angles, boundaries, and limitations around it, because I can always, you know, just knock it on the skateboard or hop off right before it goes into traffic, or choose to wear a helmet, even though I haven't yet done that. So I found all of that to be refreshing. Yes. And the option is there, but I have a really big head and I have a lot of hair, so it's hard for me to find one that works.
I thought you were going to say that you're protected. That means you'll be fine.
Oh, you know, now that I think about it, my hair is an afro, so hopefully my hair is springy enough that if I was to fall and hit my head, the curls would just like pop me back up onto my feet. A little springboard action there, you know?
You know, I mean, it's not nothing. I feel like as a gay with thinning hair, for sure, if my head hits the ground, it's... Slides out.
It's a wrap. It's a wrap on Matt Ballaside, ladies and gentlemen.
I started kind of like getting into city bike a little bit more. And I also had that moment getting on it where I was like, I don't remember the last time I rode a bike, especially in New York. It's just like terrifying to me, the idea of getting onto a bicycle around that many cars was horrifying. Wasn't too bad. I don't know what your bike experience was like.
Well, the thing about the city bike is that imagine, Matt Ballaside, that you're on a city bike and then you die. And then the first line of your obituary has to feature the name of a brand. And you're just giving this place free exposure. I mean, there's a New York Times story like Matt Ballaside, a podcast and gay around town, was found dead after clinging to a truck while he's riding his city bike down Sixth Avenue or something. Like, and then City Bank has to get involved. And then like people are like adding City Bank or City Bike on Twitter, like angry on your behalf. Like nobody wants to bring band management into this. Like leave these poor PR reps alone.
A few things that you have said that you hate that we can kind of close out with. One is that we didn't get to Halloween.
Halloween's the worst holiday. Here's the thing. My birthday's in late October. At the beginning of October, people are like, it's almost Halloween. I say, no, it's almost my birthday, which is 6 days before Halloween. Let's focus on the more important holiday in the month of October. But also, because I mentioned I went to this religious homeschool, I was raised a pretty strict Christian. I never got to celebrate Halloween, which is like, you know, fine. I still got a lot of candy in late October. I was never mad. But coming to it as an adult, I think like the first time I handed out candy on a stoop to the children was 2 years ago. I was like, this is insane. Strangers come to your house cloaked in disguises, and you're supposed to just give them things because it's not November yet. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
I love that your criticism of Halloween is not rooted in like adult party. It's the literal act of trick-or-treating and giving out candy to children.
Oh, I have no problem with drunken revelry, because I'd have 100 Halloweens over like a SantaCon or something, you know. But I don't understand. Like, I'm supposed to give you something because it's October 31st. What I do like about Halloween is that sometimes dogs wear costumes, and that is something that I can fully stand behind. But like these weird interpersonal interactions where I have to like don fake teeth and like corn syrup mixed with red food dye and give out bite-sized Snickers to strangers. Just, it feels off to me. It just doesn't make any sense.
I love the building that I'm in has a great Halloween policy, which is they send out an email to all of the apartments and they say, if you want trick-or-treaters, like, sign up, and they put a designated trick-or-treater pumpkin outside of your door to mark your apartment as, like, safe to go to. Never once have I agreed to it in the time that I've lived here, but I like that there is, it's an opt-in policy.
Oh, I mean, and that's the way it should be. In, on Christian door fronts, you know, there are signs that say something along the lines of, no tricks, no treats, just Jesus, which I'm pretty sure we hung up at one point during my childhood. Yeah, there are all sorts of things you can do to dissuade people from coming to your home and begging for sugar, but whatever. I mean, you know, people love this thing, so.
First of all, Jesus was a trick and a treat.
Okay? Jesus a little snack.
Something. He did both. I think famously he did like 30 or something tricks.
Get you a deity who can do both. Yes.
So a couple of we like to dig up your hate tweets, okay, things okay. that you've said that you've hated. You hate D.C.
I hate Washington, D.C.
Which is, I think, a fair. I don't know if anyone truly enjoys it there.
You have to know people to enjoy D.C. I don't think you can go to D.C. alone and sort of like stumble into some fun. But every time I go to D.C. and I would go from work, I would come across people who were all dressed in what people in New York were wearing 5 years ago. Like 12 years ago, like all the women were wearing like jewel tone, like peplum dresses. And all the guys were wearing like that button down shirt from Old Navy and khakis in boat shoes. Like imagine donning a boat shoe on the Eastern Seaboard during the Trump administration. Like they're just behind. It's like, it's a little bit like going back in time when you go to DC fashion wise. I think that with the exception of like the Ethiopian and Aaron Trey and food, like the food is really bad. It's very clean city, which I don't trust. Mm-hmm. Millions of people shouldn't live in a place and the streets are not full of trash. I don't understand what's going on there.
It's unnatural, yeah.
And you know, there are some like citizens, residents of Washington, D.C. who I don't agree with politically. So there we go.
Yeah. Okay, lastly, we sort of touched on this, but you have been on the record to say, the exact tweet was, happy to dox myself, ice cream is fucking gross, you are all fools.
This is my hottest take yet. I was the most unpopular person on the internet for one day, which is to say to all the people who think they've been canceled, people have been mean to me online, and I was able to survive.
Right. You didn't suddenly come out of that experience being a Trump supporter just because people canceled you for the day, in air quotes. What is ice cream? You lump it in with the sugary dessert, like the presentation of it.
No, I think that ice cream tastes like sweet mucus. It's a weird texture. It is entirely too cold for people like me with sensitive gums. I'm not even talking about, you know, like Breyers. I'm talking about Haagen-Dazs, Ben and Jerry's, or just like soft serve from a very well reputed ice cream place. I don't like the stuff. I think it's weird. I think it's cold. Anything you can't bite into feels bizarre. I'm no fan of Jello too, because I like to chew my food.
Right.
I like to know that I'm receiving nutrition. But I like what ice cream represents. You know, like childhood and laughter and summer and friendship and fun and frolicking. But you can do that and eat a potato chip at the same time.
That's true. There are also ice creams that have potato chips in them, which I'm not saying that might change your mind. I'm just saying like that exists.
Who wants that? And then the potato chip is all cold and soggy. People are crazy.
There are options out there, but I don't want to force you into experiencing an ice cream that you're not here for, which is, I guess, all ice creams. So, but it exists. McConnell's ice cream as a brand, producer Barry turned me onto it, and it is life-changing. So, but it is creamy and perhaps mucusy, and I don't know why I'm just describing the thing that you have expressed your displeasure for, but...
Because then this is going to make me hate potato chips, and then I won't have anything to eat. Then I'll just eat eggs, and you know what? And then I'll die, and it'll be all your fault, Matt Belisai.
I listen, if I can't convince you to my side, then I at least want to have corrupted you in some way. And I think I did that.
Fine. I'll give it to you. My life. My name is Jasmine Hughes. I went on Unhappy Hour, and now my life is ruined forever. Thank you so much.
Amazing. Where can people find you and your work?
Please don't find me. But I guess if someone needed to, I write for the New York Times. And you can just Google my name in New York Times. And I'm on Twitter at, you know, I don't know what my Twitter handle is. Hold on. I'm going to look it up. Because I've changed it. It's Jazzed Loon. J-A-Z-Z-E-D-L-O-O-N. What the fuck does that mean? I don't know. But that's who I am.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And I can't wait to read even more of your stuff in the New York Times.
Thank you. And if I do ever come across an ice cream I like, you'll be the first person I call.
I hope so. I expect at least that much. All right, we're almost there. We're almost at the end of the show. But first, our chasers. Chasers are the good stuff that helps all the bad shit go down easier, starting with Do Better White People, where we highlight something good we can do this week for social justice. This week, I wanted to highlight an Instagram account called Anti-Racism Daily.
Ooh, it's a good one.
Yeah, it was created by a woman named Nicole Cardoza. And guess what? It's exactly what it sounds like. every day, it's just a new post. It's a super straightforward action item for something you can do, something you can learn about to help dismantle white supremacy. Like today, when we're recording this, the post today was about understanding representation in vaccination trials.
Oh.
So like as scientists are trying to figure out a vaccine for coronavirus, it's super important that the trials that they're doing include people from minority backgrounds to be represented in these vaccination trials, if only so that the eventual vaccine kind of instills the most confidence in all types of communities. It's an incredibly useful and informative account. I found it really great and helpful, and it's also very nice and like well designed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a great like super distilled way to get a quick hit of info every day. So follow Anti-Racism Daily on Instagram. What are you watching this week, Barry?
Well, I haven't been watching a ton of TV, but I have been watching the Dune trailer over and over again. So
okay.
I know that everyone, the second that the news came out that the trailer was out, everyone who listens to Unhappy Hour probably thought, oh my God, what is Barry going to say? What is Barry going to say? Here's what I have to say. It looks like it could be really great or also super bad. So we sure. will see how it goes. I will definitely be seeing it. I don't necessarily have high hopes, but I do like to look at all of the cast members. It does look like a Star Wars boring movie, but, you know, they would do what you can. However, I also watched, it's not a TV show, but it's a fantastic documentary, and it's called Jodorowsky's Dune. And I didn't even know that Dune, they tried to make it into a movie by Jodorowsky, who is this really surrealist filmmaker in the 60s, and he wanted to make Dune. And he is such a character. And it's about how this movie that ended up not getting made has influenced all of Hollywood, especially sci-fi and Star Wars and Alien and like all of these different movies. So the documentary is great. I loved it. So that's what I was watching this week. What about you? What have you been watching?
Well, I've been incredibly stressed this week moving. And so my salve this week has been rewatching old episodes of The Great British Bake Off, which is, it's weird to rewatch like what is essentially a reality show where you know the outcome. But I can genuinely rewatch every single episode of The Great British Bake Off multiple times. I have, and I will continue to. And there are it's so calming. And also, like, because I love baking, it just like inspires me with new ideas. But there are also like so many small little moments that either I didn't pick up on in previous watches or that just delight me to see again. There was one moment that made me laugh so hard in one of the episodes. They were doing like a video package where they were at one of the contestants' homes where mm-hmm. they like interview their parents, and their parents, usually it's just like this sweet moment where the parents are like, yeah, she always loves biking. And this one contestant, her mom, she was kind of arguing with her mom, and she was like, you can't even taste anything. And her mom is clearly talking to the camera person, like sort of to the side. It's not even like the highlight of the clip. The focus is on the baker, but her mom is in the background being like, yeah, my sense of taste goes in and out because I got kicked in the face by a horse when I was a teenager. And it's like this just small moment where that you is not the focus at all, but it made me laugh so hard that I never realized that. Just like what a ridiculous thing to say. Anyway, I absolutely love that show. What is your other chaser?
So my non-TV chaser is N.K. Jemisin's The Fifth Season, which is the first book of her epic fantasy trilogy, The Broken Earth Trilogy. And it's the first time I've ever read her work, and I fucking love it. Like, the way that she writes is, like, it's quick, it's captivating, it's such an interesting world that she's built. And I'm really, really loving it. So that is my non-TV chaser this week. What about you?
Yeah, that's on my list. I'm excited to get to it. Mine is, after I spent the entire episode complaining about moving, I am very happy to be in a new place.
Yay!
And so it's my new apartment. It's that thing, like, when you're moving, they always say it's like, what, you, like, out of five things, like, you're only going to get three of the five things that you actually, like, want. Uh-huh. And there's always, like, you always have to compromise. So it is, like, especially when you're stressed, easy to be like, ugh, here's all the things that I hate, which is the idea of this entire podcast. I'm trying to focus on, like, all of the stuff that I really like about it, which is that, like, I have an entire office and studio space now that I'll be able to make a bunch of cool stuff in. And yeah, I'm happy that my move is over and that I'll get to settle in a little bit and have hopefully some peace. We'll see. Next week, I may have burned it all down. There's still time. And that's it. So thank you for listening to Unhappy Hour. You can head to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get podcasts. Hit that subscribe button, then rate us and review us, but only if it's nice. I don't want to hear your shit. Unhappy Hour is a production of Pineapple Street Studios. It's produced by Barry Finkel, Melissa Slaughter, and me, Matt Belisai. Special thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman and Max Linsky. Our music is by Hansdale Sue. You can bother Barry at Finkelberry Pie. You can worship me at Matt Belisai. And you can follow Unhappy Hour Pod on Twitter for all the latest podcast buzz. You can leave us a voicemail on our rant hotline. Give us your own rant that we may feature on the show in a future episode at 601-600-RANT. That's 601-600-7268. And that's it. That's everything. Thank you for listening. See you next week. Bye-bye. Thank you for being a friend. Golden Girls.
It's also really nice because he'll be able to help you move your stuff out of your ex-husband's house.
Right. Or yeah, he'll only be a mover forever.
I mean, like, just because a doctor retires doesn't mean he can't still perform surgery.
Sure. I mean, it does.